So Roberta Donné, award-winning recording artist, film, TV composer, producer, vocalist. Welcome to the show. And how you been? What's new? What have you been up to? What's been going on the last couple of years, I guess, you know, with the whole quarantine and everything else?
Hey, Glenn. Thanks for having me today. And a shout out to everybody that's listening and watching. I've been doing great, you know, considering all the stuff. Sorry, being a singer and being out there as a jazz singer, first of all, I just singing most of my life. So honestly, it was like a soul-crushing experience to not sing, and also to be like one of the most dangerous activities you could do during the pandemic, right? So just like no choruses, no singing. So, you know, when things started to open up again, I could see like my friends who are instrumentalists go out there and play and wear masks. But for me, it's like, it's only been really outdoor concerts, very few indoor things. And mostly I've been, we just finished scoring a movie, my writing partner, Nikki Jack and I. So Nikki Jack and Donné is a scoring team, and we just did a fantastic last year. We were very lucky. We finished one small film, and then we were able to score a feature documentary that hopefully will be out by next year, called Acting Like Nothing Is Wrong by award-winning director Jane Rosemont. And so it's been a fantastic journey for me, for us, to have actually have that kind of work during this time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and think creatively, being able to write. I started as a songwriter, you know, when I was very young. So going back to songwriting was actually, you know, very interesting, because I used to write every day, like the angst of being a young person, you know. I used to write poetry. I was like the kid in the back of the class that, very shy, but would write poetry through every class. So that turned into songwriting. And so writing a lot of songs, and started writing for my publisher again. So, that part's good. That part's good. And really being able to reflect on our lives during this time, right?
Yeah.
And see like what we've done so far and what the direction is, and making sure like, is this really the path? You know, am I being real? Am I being who I came here to be? And I think those have been the biggest questions have been the internal process, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people took advantage of the quarantine and all the downtime to kind of decompress and internalize and internally process and maybe just catch up on a lot of those passion projects. That's what I did. And I was able to, complete a lot of stuff, you know, when I was trapped in the basement. I mean, me and the wife were also kind of lucky in the fact that we brought home our first kid a couple of weeks before the lockdown even started.
Oh, wow.
So being 24/7 hands-on with him for a whole year was quite the experience. I don't think a lot of parents usually have that for the whole first year, because there weren't even any daycares available until February or March of 2021. And so it was just forced 24/7 hands-on. She's a teacher, so she was teaching virtually, and I was doing a lot of virtual remote gigs, just like this podcast looks like. I was doing a lot of corporate gigs and industrial gigs that are corporate in the same manner. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of passion projects and stuff like that that I had in the can that I needed to hurry up and catch up on. So
yeah, I was also able to catch up with family who I never spent a lot of time with, because I ran away from home when I was a teenager. And so just being able to catch up with people that, like, for years we haven't really, been in touch. My cousins in LA and I are now Zooming every week. It's just like amazing to have connections. But what a blessing to have time with your son, a new baby like that. That's like probably every parent's dream is just to spend more time with kid, even though it's forced. That's amazing. But I do really feel for young people right now. When I was a kid, we just ran around outside all day and night and played with our friends and went to school and had, it's just I really feel for the young people right now.
Yeah, I mean it's tricky. It's definitely tricky, especially for kids going trying to go to the park and trying to experience daycare and that sort of thing. And yeah. And us taking, there was a lot of things that we weren't able to that he missed out because we were just trapped, essentially trapped in the house. Taking him to parks, taking him to beaches. Taking to the lakes and stuff like that. Grandparents coming over all the time and seeing them. The grandparents especially had the shelter in place, being senior citizens, being more susceptible and at risk. And there was with the downs came the ups though, and I felt, it was a great opportunity to take advantage of those of the ups as for with the pros. And
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really interesting time on the consciousness level of people in general. I think if people didn't face their own lives before, they're kind of forced to now. And I think, a global consciousness or whatever is going on, and I think people are opening up and rediscovering, or just learning. Like, I'm a big history buff, so I always studied history, and I love history and historic projects. So, just learning history, being able to watch movies, binge watch a whole lot of movies or shows.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of shows. There was a lot of shows we binged watched on and caught up on, a lot of movies that we caught up on, and a lot of stuff that, started watching over again. And I noticed, me and the wife actually, I'm pretty sure it had to do with bringing a kid home, but we purchased, Disney Plus, and we purchased like all these other streaming services and all these premium package services of other services. We had like the cheap version of stuff like that. So, a lot of binge watching and some reading. And my wife actually reads paper books, actual physical books. Sometimes I'll just read an ebook here and there. I did buy a book of a guest I had about a year ago. I had somebody on the show, Brant Pinvidic, wrote The 3 Minute Rule, and it's how to pitch something within 3 minutes.
Oh,
So I
cool.
actually bought that book just because he was on there. So and I kind of read up on the book, so I bought it. And it's a great book, learning a lot from it, but it takes me forever to get through like these physical books. But if it was an ebook or an audiobook, I might start delving into audiobooks. But all that stuff in your Netflix watch list, man, you got to catch up on that stuff. There was a whole good year, March 2020 to March 2021 was just binge watch time with the family. So, now here we are, it's September 2021. Have you been back in the studio? Have you been back on a set, back on stage, back on location? Back at the venues, back at the clubs, the bars, the
So
patios,
yes,
whatever.
I have done. Let's see, last year I did three outdoor shows, I think. I have one on Sunday this week, and I'm playing at Birdland in New York in November. I just had a gig in San Francisco, which the venue decided. I'm in San Francisco, by the way. Decided to shut down. Somebody in their family got sick, and I think the ventilation in the place, it was an indoor gig, and I was really struggling, like, should I go and do this? There's a lot of people around me. I know a lot of people that got COVID, And so just being super vigilant and really careful, you know. But
Yeah.
anyway, I got the email saying that they were closing again, and I was like, oh, okay, I don't have to make that decision. So that's
Hey, sometimes, man,
good.
sometimes the decisions were real easy to make over the last year.
Sometimes it's protection, you know. I learned that over my life when I remember, you know, and I'm a Buddhist, so I chant for things. I do Nam-myoho-renge Kyo. By the way, I just read Tina Turner's new book,
And
Happiness
she's
Comes
a,
With.
didn't she become a Buddhist?
So she's actually the one who introduced me. Her very first book is how I learned about it. But I was going to say, yeah, I mean, you know, chanting for things, I learned that sometimes you don't get something that you really want, but then in the end, it's protection. Because you know, because it opens a door to something else that's even better. So I've noticed that a lot. Yeah, so right now I'm recording here every day. We have a home studio, so very, very fortunate that way. And you know, we were able to have we had an outside singer come in for the film. We did everything from, I'd say, funk dance music for this film to, you know, just regular, you know, beautiful scoring instrumental music, and a lot of writing, you know. So that's what's happening right now. And I'm also getting ready to record two new albums. I want to say one, obviously, first I'm going to concentrate on, and it's something that I haven't done before. And I don't want to give it away till it's kind of ready. But the last three albums, I was signed to two different labels that are jazz historic projects, 1920s and 30s, the roots of jazz. So my band is called the Prohibition Mob. Prohibition Mob band. The guys dress like, you know, gangsters from the 1930s. It's really a fun project. And
Speakeasy, the speakeasy,
yeah.
what would they call that back in the 20s? Ragtime jazz. Yeah.
Yeah, well, ragtime was actually before before
Jazz.
swing started, you
Okay.
know. But you know, the era that we started in, so you know, Prohibition started in 1920 and it ended in 1933, actually. So we do music anywhere from 1920 up through actually 1939. That was like our that was like our perimeter of music. And I tended to find music that was really obscure. Songs that had never been re-recorded, I tried to find those, and it was a really interesting project. And of course, we have horns in the band, and it's just a very fun project. I have a band, actually, the same band that I have in San Francisco. I started a band in New York, and one in Seattle, one in LA, one in Atlanta, and one in Philadelphia. And so that's how I was able to tour a little bit more, because just carrying around a rhythm section, you know, I could lose my shirt just, you know, carrying people around, flying around, getting hotel rooms, you know. And by the time you do all that, and then, you know, and then you have to play the gig, and if it's the door, you're paying, you know, sometimes you're playing at a little jazz venue for the door, and it's like, oh my God, at the end of the night, and then the owner gives you the money. Or the bartender, and you're like, you're kidding me, right? Like 40 people came in, but they didn't charge them. Oh yeah, but they were in the back drinking, and you're like, you know. So it's a real, you have to be very tough to be a band leader, and that's just the band leader part. That's the hardest thing of what I do, I think, the band leader thing. And then I've been lucky enough to be a side person. So I was in a very well-known kind of a iconic band called Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks. I was in that band for 10 and a half years. And Dan passed away in 2016. So that was a really great job. That was my day job for all those years. And you know, just learning that music, he had an incredible, what an iconic American songwriter. Brilliant songwriter. And kind of created his own genre, which he called folk swing. And so, because of that music, I was able to learn, and he was a huge jazz fan too, and we did a lot of jazz type music. So through that, I was able to really study more roots music than I would have been normally exposed to,
Yeah.
and folk music too, which was really great. But just playing acoustic music in general is a beautiful thing, because when I first started and I first came to San Francisco, I almost lost my hearing playing in rock bands. I remember going to a little bar somewhere in the city, and they were testing the drums, and I happened to be on the stage, and I shouldn't have been on the stage, and the guy just went bam, like once on the snare drum, and I felt this like piercing thing in this ear,
Yeah.
and I had a headache all night. I didn't know what was going on, but I realized I just really damaged my ears. And after singing that music for a number of years, and I was singing a lot of hotels and what we call casuals, which is like corporate, big corporate bands and corporate work. But playing electric music, after a while, I realized it's really hurting my hearing. It happens to a lot of musicians, a lot of
Yeah.
people.
Yeah, that happened to Brian Johnson at AC/DC. And
Yeah.
there was this myth going around. Everybody kept saying like it was his throat. Something happened. I'm like, no. It's his tendonitis, I think it's called
Yeah.
tendonitis, where
Tinnitus, yeah.
he had to leave the tour and get surgery done on his ear. And this was
Yeah.
about 5 or 6 years ago. Axl Rose took over touring with AC/DC as the front man. And then Brian Johnson, recovered from the surgery. I guess, the ringing and the constant, the pain and ringing is gone. And then these guys, I think Angus is just pushing 80, and I think Brian is just pushing 70. And during quarantine, they just came out with a new album, Power Up. And there's a couple of tracks on there that are good, like I'm kind of a purist when it comes to AC/DC, but there's some tracks on there that really stand out, and these guys are just not stopping, But yeah, I mean that's a tricky thing, especially not I'm currently in the DC National Guard, so being in the military and your body just starts falling apart, and you can't lift your shoulder half more than this without pain, and you got to carry stuff, and you got to like.
Oh yeah.
Put on, you got to put on gear and put it, and just putting on like a jacket hurts sometimes, because you're just so beat up. Or, yeah. And so I'm looking forward to, progressing in life and just solely being a civilian. And that's, that pretty soon in the future, just solely being a civilian and acting and filmmaking. And living on set and doing that. I mean, and thank you. I know you mentioned you checked out my website, checked out some of my stuff, and hopefully that's just the beginning.
Oh, sure.
Just keep progressing from there.
Yes.
But like you, going back to what you were saying, this quarantine and the shelter in place was a great opportunity to, work on the music. I mean, and not to say it's easy artistically, but it was probably easy technically to continue to produce music with just equipment. To make a film, you kind of need a cast and crew and set. But
Right.
to make music, I mean, I kind of give I two of my colleagues, you mentioned the Zombie Squad branding here, but two of my colleagues who are kind of like, that's one of them. I don't know. Anyway, two of my colleagues, Tech Fall and Durko, they're both musicians as well. And I was giving a hard time, like, hey, listen, it's quarantine. It's time to, churn out some tracks. They do EDM and like hip hop instrumentals and stuff like that. And they said, it's not that easy. It's not that easy. Okay, so I went on my phone and I got this app, Groovepad. And a week later, I sent them, four tracks, very simple stuff. And it's the app obviously supplies you with these samples, and these samples, I think, are loose. I think it's open source copyright or whatever, but I've been using the tracks that I made, and I haven't gotten hit with a copyright infringement. So I must think these must be open source samples.
Yeah, those are samples. Probably when you buy the app, I don't know that particular app, but probably when you buy it, it comes with those samples, and those have been cleared already, so there wouldn't be any copyright infringement.
Yeah.
Although Naked Jack and I wrote a song for a publisher, and when we were uploading it to YouTube, that's the interesting thing is YouTube, right?
Yeah.
YouTube has all these like little things that come in and test stuff, and we had one song that it turned out they kept saying, like copyright infringement, even though it didn't say that. It sounds like another song. So they actually showed like from this second to this second in
Yeah.
the track, and it sounds like this. So we went and we looked up the artist. We never heard of him. He was a Czechoslovakian artist, right? So I thought, well, maybe the lyric sounds, so the melody didn't sound anything like our song. And it was so different, but I thought, well, maybe the lyrics. So we looked it up. Of course, he's singing in Czech.
Yeah.
So it didn't sound like our song. So the only thing we could figure out was that there was a repeat melody, and not even the melody itself, but just the groove of the melody
Yeah.
was similar. And I said, let's take the length of the song. It turned out that the length of the song was similar. So between that second and that second, that repeat that we did in our song reminded them of this song,
Right.
even though it had no possible way of being copyright infringement. But I said, well, why don't we lengthen our song? And that's what we did. We had a different write out, and as soon as we did that, the thing went away.
Yeah.
But
Right.
I was
You had to
like,
do that right out. And
wow, like we had
like you
to do
said,
detective work to
right.
figure out,
And like you said, I subscribe to another service that gives some free music samples that I've used in some of my projects, just because on short notice I would need some music for something. And I always get a hit, but you got to download. You have to download the licensing. It's like a text document that comes with the music with the MP3 download. And then you gotta out and then you got a dispute and you upload this license and you copy it and you paste it into the box that is your explanation of, you're partnered with somebody or you own the license or you purchase license or something or other, blah, 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 blah. And you gotta do that every single time you get that hit. And there's times where I didn't have copyright. So I was just like, okay. So, I mean, a lot of times what will happen with YouTube is you get hit with a copyright, but you won't get a warning. You won't get a strike against you. It's just the copyright owner will get the Google AdSense, will get the pay the advertising payout instead of you. And if you're willing to suck that up for that one video, but still get the views and still get the subscribers, then your other videos will then benefit from that. But it's yeah, YouTube has a weird thing with that sometimes. But yeah. Like,
Yeah, we watch one guy who's has a really great music show. His name is Rick Beato, Beato, I think. And he's got millions of subscribers, I guess. And he does, what makes this song great? And he has different, shows and stuff. But he does a lot of, taking apart the song and discussing it. And if he played a clip of the original song or whatever, sometimes he gets hit with these copyright, these things on YouTube, and man, it's just a big battle.
Well, I think with a lot of folks like that. So there's another channel I watch, totally different. It's this channel called Wrestling Bios, and he does retrospective videos about professional wrestling back in like the 90s. And he's using clips, he's using pictures, he's using some of those wrestlers' entrance theme songs. And he doesn't really care about the copyright infringements from YouTube. He doesn't care about the Google AdSense because he's got a Patreon. So that's probably where Beato is making up for it. There's a lot of YouTubers that get supporters and financial backing from Patreon. So he's making money
He's
from
not
Patreon.
on
Okay.
Patreon. He actually doesn't ask for money. He just sells his books, and that's it. But I don't think he actually makes money from YouTube. Maybe he does, but I think most of his income is, you know, people do their thing for different reasons, you know.
Right.
But yeah. But
I'd love to make money on YouTube.
I know,
I mean,
right?
I would love to get some of the shows that are on you pick some of my web series picked up by a network. Like, hey, take a look at this DC thing I got going on. Take a look at this Marvel thing I got going on. I think Disney Plus or Warner Brothers would have a field day with it, you know. But at the same time, I would love to make money from the YouTube. I just gotta like get these subscribers up somehow, get the viewership up somehow. I mean,
Yeah,
it's just a constant battle.
we had a favorite show we used to watch called My Drunk Kitchen. And there was this young girl who started this show, and she just would drink and be cooking, and she's a terrible chef. She would just be making like really simple things, but botch it up because she was getting drunk and be falling down, and just hilarious. But kind of obviously a really natural comedian. And we followed her for a really long time, and then one day we found out she had a TV show, because she had so many subscribers. So I think that thing in our culture of people getting famous on YouTube, that's such a huge change from how I grew up. And for us it was about getting the record deal. It was all about gotta get the record deal, gotta get. We didn't know what to do with it once we had that, but
Well, I saw in your text that you have this album or two ready for distribution. You're working with labels. What's stopping you from self-distribution, say iTunes and Spotify and Apple Music, going just directly to that?
so that's fine. I have, let's see, 9 solo albums out. So the first 6 albums were self. I had a record label I started called Rainforest Records, and I have Rainforest Productions. I'm a Rainforest person, obviously. And that was my goal. My goal was save the rainforest, give a percentage to the rainforest, thinking I'm gonna, make millions of dollars. And but anyway, it was just so difficult being the business person, because it's really more than just Spotify. And to get out there and really be out there in a big way, for me, being part of a label is like being part of a family, and everybody's working behind you to get something out there. So like the one of the labels I was on, they took care of the artwork, the manufacturing of the CD. They paid for some of my recording on the second record, and all the things that they did, I could not have afforded to do that, get the press, get the radio, get all that coverage. So it's a huge difference in the cost, although looking back, like that label took all of my digital, that all went to them. So yeah, I mean, I had to buy my record from them, actually. The physical copies, I had to buy it back for $7 a CD, and then I could sell it at a show for like $15 or $20, right? But looking back, I mean, there's really pros and cons. A lot of people don't want to deal with record labels, and record labels aren't what they used to be. They used to develop artists, and they used to like work with you and all kinds of stuff. Basically, a lot of them are distribution houses. For me, the next 2 records, I'm interested in this one record that was already recorded in 2011 with Bob Dureau, who's now passed away. So Bob Dureau is a jazz master. He's a jazz icon, songwriter, performer. He worked with Miles Davis, and did he did a whole show for children. What was it called? Anyway, he wrote music teaching numbers, for instance, in a children's show that was really, really popular. So anyway, I have a record with him that was done. It's just him and me, and he's a piano player, and then we both sang. And so he has 2 new compositions on that record, and nobody's heard them yet. And so because he's a jazz standard writer, I know that's a big deal. And then there's a few covers that we did that he had previously recorded with Blossom Dearie. And Blossom Dearie was around in the 50s and 60s. She was around for quite a while, but she was came out of the bebop era, you know,
Yeah.
piano player, singer. And her music, you can hear it on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel when that show came out, which is an incredible show. I just like can't wait for the next season to come. They actually play her music, which nobody ever hears, you know, that music
Yeah.
particularly. But anyway, so the album is been sitting there. A pub producer from New York produced the record and owns the record. And because I have no legal, it doesn't belong to me, I can't release it. So I will, you know, I call him once in a while and say, "Hey, can you release that record? Can you release that record?" But he's not releasing it for whatever reason. He's sitting on it, and so my idea is to go to the major labels in jazz who are interested in hearing this, you know, Bob Dureau compositions. And I'm so fortunate, right? Out of all the jazz singers he could have picked in the world, he picked me to sing with him. So that's an amazing, you know, honor to work with him. And it was a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm chanting that this will actually happen at some point, will come out. And but meanwhile, I'm recording two other projects and. We haven't quite started. I'm still working on the selection of songs, but they'll both have a theme. I like theme kind of projects, you know, and I think they're going to be really fun. One of them I just found out I'm going to be working with Mike Greensill, who is an incredible jazz pianist from up here. He's actually originally from Scotland. And he worked for many years. I think he did 14 to 16 albums with his wife at the time, Wessla Whitfield, who passed away a few years ago. And they were produced by the producer, that's how I met them, who I worked with, who like kicked me into jazz, named Oren Keepnews. And Oren Keepnews started Riverside Jazz Records in the 1950s. So his first artist was Thelonious Monk. So he started the careers of so many jazz musicians, and that was an amazing honor for me because I was on the board for the Recording Academy, the Grammy organization, you know, locally, San Francisco chapter, and he was, you know, had been there for 50 years already or whatever. So when I met him, you know, because I was a jazz fan, I asked him some questions. And he said, "What do you know about Thelonious Monk?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm a huge jazz fan." So we were able to start this friendship, and he said, "You know, I'll take you to lunch and tell you all about him, you know." And instead, he took me to jazz clubs like Yoshi's, which is like one of the big jazz clubs here. And you know, I got to hear amazing people I wouldn't have heard. And anyway, he really, really encouraged me. To sing jazz after he heard me sing. And then he produced an album with me. So it's a really kind of a full circle thing because the arrangements and the fabulous piano playing of Mike Greensill is very much related to Oren. You know, that history with Oren is there. And then Oren and I recorded two of Bob Dureau's songs on that first record called What's Your Story. That was my first jazz record. So that came out on another label in 2008. And it did really well. And I really thought for sure the jazz people are usually, it's a very kind of small, you know, it's like I think 1% of the music industry is jazz. You know,
Yeah.
it's a tiny, tiny segment of the population. But they're very particular, you know. Like I had an album out just before that called Back Before the Why, which was written for public, you know, most of the songs I wrote for film and TV at the time were written. This particular project, they wanted electronica mixed with ambient chill jazz. It was kind of, you know, European, you know, like this Euro sound that was happening at the time, which was ambient chill, was it called? It was before EDM came about, right? And amazing. So this album came out, and two songs were signed to some TV shows and did really well. And they said, the producer said, "Well, we really like the sound," and everything that they liked had flugelhorn on it. So I put flugelhorn on all the songs, and anyway, they told me what it should sound like. So I did a whole album like that, which is still getting picked up. I mean, I just had a song off of there on General Hospital. Yeah, so different, shows from the publisher will pick up songs. But anyway, I gave that to like the jazz people while I was working on this other album, and the jazz radio people wouldn't play the record because why? Not real drums, for one thing. Number two, the music was original, right? That's hard enough. And because I'm a singer, that's something else. That's a smaller part of the population. Like most of what jazz radio plays, instrumental music. Right, which is great. But the number of singers or vocal music that you'll hear is very small. So on top of that, I had like, some of the choruses would repeat, so it sounded like a pop song. So they were like, "Oh, this is..." So I was kind of banned from the whole jazz thing on that record, and I got sold somehow as a smooth jazz to some festival at the time, but it was like a flute thing.
Smooth jazz. I remember, smooth
Yeah,
jazz.
remember smooth jazz?
Smooth
And it's
jazz
still out.
105.9 in P, like in the PG area we were talking about, and that's what my mom listened to all the time. Smooth jazz 105.9.
You know, and I really loved when smooth jazz came out, but for a lot of musicians that are, around me and stuff, we would call it like, it sounds like the intro that never takes off. It's like you hear the intro to the song and it keeps going, but you never get to the bridge, or just whatever it was.
Smooth jazz sounds like the intro, just on repeat.
Like I went to see this, fabulously very famous pianist at the time at a big, concert hall and everything. So I was real excited and everything. And he came out and he sat down and he put his finger on a note and he sat there for like 20 seconds and then went to one. And I was like, "Oh my God, this is it? This is, So, it was, it's calming music, I think it was great in the healing arts and stuff. Smooth jazz, kind of came out of that and then went into a different, a different genre now, basically. And I really love it, But anyway, so when the first real jazz record came out, which was this one with Oren Kepnes, and it was with Eric Reed Trio. Eric Reed is a fabulous pianist out of New York and had his trio out here. So we recorded here at Fantasy Records at the time, Fantasy Studios. And that was the first real jazz thing, and I didn't know what would happen when it came out because it goes again to all the press people and all, all the writers, and it went to, Downbeat magazine, it went to all these places. And I thought, uh-oh, what are they going to say? Because if they look me up, they're going to find all this like pop kind of music or, stuff I was writing as a singer-songwriter, which was like alternative, whatever it was called. But no, they totally embraced it. That was amazing.
Mean, I think the trick is to just enjoy what you're doing, whether it's smooth jazz or whether it's pure jazz, the purest pure jazz, or it's pop. I mean, if you're having a good time, if you got a hell of a damn good voice, and your voice works for both pop, smooth jazz, jazz, rock, R&B, so be it. I mean, I don't think you working on an R&B hip hop album should negatively affect your potential work on a jazz album. I mean, I just never really understood like the purists and like, oh, this person's gonna have to, I'm gonna have to blackball this person because
Well, it's like,
they did something that turned out to be really popular
yeah.
and made some money from it.
You know, it's also, yes, I agree. And you know, I always just said, well, I'm a singer, I can sing anything, you know? So I trained myself in all these different kinds of music. And so, yeah, I mean, the only thing I don't think I could really tackle is opera at this point, you know? But I remember, you know, back in the day, Bob Dylan, you know, went from, he was playing acoustic guitar, right? And he went from that to a band, and all of a sudden he was playing electric, you know, rock and roll. And boy, the fans were like really pissed. They were angry. They were booing him.
I remember
That
exactly
kind
the
of stuff would.
concert when he plugged that thing in and people booed him and he goes, and just played anyway.
I mean, that kind of stuff happens. It usually happens more in terms of the fans, I guess. You know, and I got criticized one day. It was really a bad criticism, and I was like, oh sh, you know, uh-oh. And what it was was I was headlining a jazz festival locally, and I was really happy and had great jazz band and everything. And an agent, this woman came up to me who wanted to represent me, and she looks down and she sees I have these albums sitting there, and she picks them up, and they were all my singer-songwriter albums because I didn't have a jazz album out yet. You know, so I brought my records, and she picks it up, and she started yelling at me. She's like, how am I supposed to sell you? You know, if you're doing different genres, if you're going to do jazz, you have to have a jazz album, and that's all. I don't want to see anything else. And she really like gave it to me and called me later, wrote me like angry emails and stuff. And I realized what it is it makes their job harder. It's not that it doesn't come from the artist. Like, we don't sit around going, well, we have to stay in a different, you know, certain path. It comes from the people that are trying to sell us. And I understand from her point of view, she's right. I understand that,
There
you
was
know.
some there was something that came up not too long ago. I was discussing it, and it's like these people's job is not really important. The person that was contacting me, they're trying to make their existence and their paycheck viable. And it's not. You're the singer, you're the artist, the composer, the musicians, the instrumentalists, the mixer. But then there's somebody sitting at a desk that needs to, oh, geez, I wish I could remember exactly the other situation. And it's just like, what do you do? This person that called you. And it's and then you're telling me like numerous emails and text messages and voicemails to follow up. Like, okay, great, I heard you the first time. But this person has a 9 to 5 doing this and they need to make that position or they're going to be out of a job. They don't make music, but they're going to harp on you. You need to be jazz and only jazz, and you need to be bebop, jazz. And it's like, why? It, but because if I'm on a hit album and no one gives a shit about jazz right now, and then I'm on a bebop jazz album now, people might start giving a shit about jazz again because I was on an album with Aretha Franklin oh my what's the new artist that did Hello? I can't. Adele.
Adele.
I'm on a. I'm singing with Adele. I'm singing with Lady Gaga. I'm singing with Beyonce. And now I'm on this bebop album by you guys. That name recognition is going to make people buy the freaking bebop out al jazz album.
Hopefully, yes.
But it's.
I agree. However, two different thoughts here. One is, I agree with you to a point. I think without, just like without fans, you know, none of us have a gig, basically. Without agents and managers and people that put those tours together, without the people that book us that are sitting at a desk, you know, without the people that, you know, when they had A&R at the record company, none of us would have a record deal either. So, you know, there's both sides to that, and I do. I learned, you know, many, many years ago, because I had to get, always did side jobs, you know, to make a living, to fill in for what I wasn't earning as a singer or whatever. So I mean, I had one job working for a guy selling bands to corporate, huge corporate events. And so my job was like one of those people's jobs where I sat on the phone And I loved it. You know, I got to talk to people about their weddings, which is like, what a headache, right? But because I got to book bands, I was very excited to do that. And I learned so much about that side of the industry, you know, and being a band leader and having to book myself too, and having to learn the business of music, you know, like I took a class on copyright law when I was very young, first, you know, being a songwriter coming here. I really wanted to learn the business because I knew if I didn't learn the business, I couldn't protect myself. And I started a publishing company myself too, you know, for my own recordings. But anyway, but I did learn something that I'll share with you, the other side of that, which is that, you know, I was, I think, 21 years old, and I had a demo I had made, and it was picked up by a major label in LA. And I was in this little band, and some guy in the band had a friend who was A&R guy or something. And so I got a call, and they said, "We're really interested in you as an artist." And so I was getting ready to go to LA, and they said, "We need more music." And so I went down to meet the guy, and this particular company, they were firing A&R people, you know, every 3 months. If the guy said, you know, I found this out about A&R people, like I found out that Prince was turned down by every record label before he was signed. This happened over and over again, you know, because if you were an A&R person and you said yes to something and it didn't fly, you could get fired. So you didn't get fired for saying no. You only got fired for saying yes, right?
That
So,
makes no sense to me.
yeah, so the new
Okay.
A&R person would come and I'd go down to LA and have a meeting with them. And they, you know, they didn't get the music. And they wanted me to stay, and that was kind of like that, you know, that genre thing where you have to, you know, we heard you do this thing, which was kind of like a Latin, it was kind of jazz, it was kind of bluesy, it was kind of folky, whatever it was. They tried to figure out what that was because that's where they're going to sell you. And now, by the time I get down to LA, I have, oh, well, I'm doing this now.
Right.
And I kept going like, well, you know, what about Sting or Joni Mitchell? I mean, at the time I was just thinking, I'm an artist, I can just do music. I'm not thinking how to sell it. That's not my job, really. It's not my job. But anyway, finally, after being on hold for a while, I got in touch with this guy, and he was the new A&R guy, this major record label, and said, "Come on down, we'd love to hear your new, you know, music." And I went down there, and I had to sit in this office with him, and he literally took apart every song. There was like five songs on this demo, and he just ripped them to shreds. I'm not saying he was wrong or anything, but he ripped them to shreds to the point where I was just like, I had to get up and run to the elevator so I could cry. It was like I couldn't wait to get out of there so I could just bawl. Because, you know, if somebody said like, you know, we don't like your voice, I didn't think anything of being criticized for different things. But if you don't like my song, like that's my child, you know? And I felt like somebody just slapped my child, right? And so he was like tearing apart the songs. He was not emotional enough. It's not this, it's not that, it's not hooky, whatever it was. And these are like my precious children. So anyway, I learned from that experience, and that you know, I got out of there. I was crying. I was thinking, I'm going to quit. You know, this is never going to happen. Blah, blah, blah. I get to my friend's house and I told him, and I was really, really upset. And he said, "You know, just watch what happens. Just watch what happens because you're the artist, right?" So a couple of years go by, maybe a few years go by, and I go to a songwriting conference. Now that A&R guy got fired, and he's now selling a book, a handmade book, you know, run off and stapled and copied by him, of contacts in the field, in the record company field, right, for artists. So he's a salesman now, right, basically. And I thought, oh my God. And of course I said hi, I'm really friendly, and he remembers me and stuff. But I realized I have a new record out now, it's sitting there, you know, being sold and stuff. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, there it is. You know, I'm the artist, I'm still working. This guy lost his job, and now he's, you know, a sales guy, basically. So I could see
He's
over
selling a
time.
phone book of other reps. Okay.
Yeah, Basically, contacts. And there's a lot of people that make a living in our industry. You have to be careful if you're an artist, actually. And I became a record producer for other artists, so I was always, people will come in and they'll say, we can get you blah 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 blah. And you just buy this list, or you just buy this, or you just pay me to, whatever it is. And a lot of our industry is people making a living off of artists, because people have their dream and they're like, So I've seen that happen a lot, and
I've seen, I know a couple of guys that were musicians. They made great music and now they want to rep other artists. And it's like, dude, make your own music.
Well, I think it's fine actually if you rep other artists, if you're the manager and you have the, let's say you have the background, you made the contacts, and you know how to get that person from here to there. Like I was able to produce an artist, for instance, that got signed to a record deal. For me, that was a great thing because I know without my, it happened two or three times, I think, but without my production of that music, they probably wouldn't have gotten to that point. But of course, I'm just
No, but
looking
you
at the,
produced the music too.
right, I'm the artistic person. I didn't bring them to that person,
Right.
However, there was a time when I was booking a series for female singer-songwriters in San Francisco, and I booked this for about 3 years. In the first year, I booked 125 artists played on that series, which is an amazing amount when you look at that, just that number of people, that I was helping to showcase.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, and that was good. And then you could look at me like, oh, I was the agent for that. I was also one of the artists, but we started this cooperative for actually female artists to learn how to support each other. Because I realize as women, this is a really different culture, growing up in it, and it's, hopefully much better now than it used to be. But I noticed that women, girls growing up, they're not on, say, baseball teams, they're not on teams, they don't have the boys' club. A lot of women are raised to compete with each other, which is a very bizarre thing
Yeah.
to me. Like, I grew up, I always loved women, so actually I'm a bi girl, I grew up looking at women like a guy would look at a woman, So I was like, wow, women, So I was one, always wanted to support women. I never thought about competing with other women at all. But these female artists were doing that. And
Oh
so
yeah.
they were all, they were not being able to help each other. So when we created this cooperative, my friend and I, Amy and I, decided, let's, I said, let's teach them how to do that, which also came from my Buddhist training, how to really support other people. And it was a really interesting thing to see that. And yeah, and I mean, I was then on a tour once with two other female singer-songwriters, and we were in LA, and the younger one, her mother, and because they were living in LA, she came from LA, most of the audience was coming for her, which was great, and we all had fans coming. It was a big, rock club or whatever. And but the mother had told all of her friends and her daughter's friends, don't clap for the other singers. Now
Yeah, it's crazy.
the three of us are on stage at the same time, three songwriters, and a songwriter in the round is where, one person does a song and the next person, and sometimes we back each other up or whatever, but we were like a team. And then suddenly, when she wasn't playing, there's no clapping in the audience. It was like, what? And I realized that, and I had to say that to her later, your mother taught you to compete with other women, and that's a bad thing to do. It's not good, it's not healthy, it's not good for you. It must feel horrible, right? Because then you're constantly comparing yourself and doing this whole girl kind of whatever that is, which is a
Yeah.
very superficial, outside
Almost like these beauty pageant moms, right?
beauty pageant.
Yeah.
Beauty pageant. So, yeah, so that was a really interesting time, and I learned from doing that that a lot of women did not learn how to do that. They did never learned how to support other women, and so I'm very aware of that in my industry, and always really trying to support my other female artists, you know,
Yeah.
because it's tough. It's tough to be a woman in our industry and it's all men. I mean, literally, you know, you're in a band, there's five musicians and there's you. You're the
And
only girl in the van going to the gig. You're the only girl, you know, and it's a really, and it's tough. And even female instrumentalists had a tough time, to the point where there's a documentary made called Girls in the Band, The Girls in the Band. Really fantastic documentary if you guys ever get a chance to see it. And it's what it's about is women instrumentalists in the 30s and 40s who couldn't get hired to play in the big bands with men. And the reasoning was the men would say, we don't want a girl, we don't want a chick on the bus. You know, we don't want to have to deal, like, we don't want to have to watch our language in front of a girl, whatever it was that they thought they had to do. So these women would audition for these bands and never get hired. However, a couple of times the bands would do blind auditions. So you know what that means? That means the person's like behind a curtain playing and they're just listening. And 30% at that point of who was hired were women. What a difference, right? Just because they didn't see it was a woman. So that was a big thing, and that just came out in the jazz world, you know, on festivals. You know, I was talking to this guy who was like a DJ somewhere in New York, and he was telling me that he had done his own, you know, his own research on this, and found that at jazz festivals, for instance, it was something like 10% of the players are women. And only 3% of the headliners are women. So, I mean, that's got to change. And Monterey Jazz Festival changed that, you know, a couple of years ago, but only because the women did a protest, a huge protest. And there were, you know, hundreds or thousands of
That Me Too
signatures.
movement, that Me Too movement storming through. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what's going on now, is like a lot of things have to shift, you
Yeah.
know. And have to change, and a lot of things that, you know, the cry for justice, you know, the cry for
Absolutely.
peace and for people to be equal is a big, big deal.
Yeah.
So I'm happy, you know, during the pandemic, there's a lot of, you know, horrible things like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all the people that had to go through this. But to show the world, like, this needs to change. It needs to change now. For that, I'm grateful that people have been, that they get to see it, you know, and because of the pandemic, they couldn't really escape it. So I think that's part of our human revolution as, you know, global consciousness. You know, I think that's part of our lesson of what's going on. But every individual has to do this themselves. You know, nobody can do this part for you. And that's where the work comes in.
Yeah.
No.
Well, you know, touching upon that, what drives you? What's your driving force? You know, thinking about like, you know, all the choices you make and you know, going back to, you know, pushing for women to support each other and, you know, touching upon a lot of the things you just mentioned. What drives you? What's your driving force?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a great question. I think, you know, when I first started chanting, I used to ask, the question was like, why did I come here? Why did I come to this planet at this time? Why did I land here? You know, why did I grow up in DC? You know, why did I run away from home? I mean, all those things. Why did I become a musician? You know, why did I live through, I wasn't supposed to live past being a teenager because I had a really bad health disease as a child. I was really sick a lot. So, I mean, what was it that you came here for? You know, it's a really big question. And what I came to was, I came here to create because I'm an artist, you know. I came here to create, and I think most creative people just have that drive underneath everything. You wake up in the morning and you're like, what am I going to create? You know. I mean, Buster Williams told us one day, Buster Williams is a very famous jazz bassist, and he actually introduced Herbie Hancock to the practice Namyoho Renge Kyo, the chanting that we do. Anyway, he told us once, he said, being an artist is like checking into a hotel, and the guy behind the desk says, you just have to make your own bed. And you're like, sure, I can make my own bed. But then he hands you the nails and the boards and the springs, and you're like, and that's what it's like every day to wake up as an artist. You're like, uh-oh, like, here's the stuff and I have to create something.
Yep.
But the purpose behind that for me, and it's very simple, I think it's just to really encourage people. You know, it comes from love.
Yeah.
You know, loving humanity, you know, loving the planet, loving all living things, all living beings, and wanting to encourage them. Because when I grew up in DC, I saw a lot of suffering, really intense suffering. And I saw it every day. You know, I saw it when I went to school, I saw it when I got on the bus to go to work. I just saw it all day long, the people suffering, and I could feel it. And I thought, wow, you know, and I was taught to come here and suffer. Like, that's what my family taught me. And I thought, that's not right. I didn't come here to suffer, you know.
Yeah.
I came here to be happy, you know. So how do we find our happiness? And everybody has to answer that for themselves, you know.
Well, I think it's also a choice. I mean, people choose to be selfish. It's a conscientious choice to be selfish. It's a conscientious choice to be lazy and miserable. And it's a conscientious choice at a certain point in time, obviously, to do the wrong thing versus the right thing. And, you know, for me, yeah, I always wanted to create and entertain and inspire and be an artist, an actor. And then, you know, me and the wife, you know, I met the wife and I was determined to show her that I was capable of succeeding at the acting and the filmmaking. And then we had the kids. So now there's this bigger determination to leave a legacy. And I always, you know, as an artist, I never settled down for the longest time. Never focused on marriage and kids for the longest time because it was got to set up the full-time freelance, got to set up the empire, got to set up that the system of being an artist, whether it's acting, filmmaking, you know, directing, writing, assistant directing, or acting, or whatever the case, live streaming events, you know, just gig by gig by gig, but set it up to where that's the full-time thing. But once that became the full-time thing, then it was like, okay, now I'm set. And now it's, you know, and then I just happened to meet Melissa, my now wife, and I was like, oh boy, here we go. Fell in love. I just know I'm going to marry this one and have kids. And there was this kind of, you know, itch in the back of my head, you know, don't settle. You're settling down with her and you're going to settle down with the family, but don't settle down on the drive and the persistence of the craft and of the gigs and of the hustle. Everybody, you know, talks about the hustle. Don't settle down on the hustle. You got to ramp it up because now you got to feed two people. Now you got to feed three people in this kind of lifestyle. It's, you know, kind of in this kind of career field, it's very high risk. So, and that's what I found happened was quarantine happened. Going to still stay productive, start a podcast, finish up these passion projects, release those things, try to get them out, continue to build viewership on the YouTube channel. And then that kind of turned in, that kind of showed a lot of people my capabilities of remote live streaming work. And they're like, yeah, that's what we're doing now. And so I got a shitload of work during the quarantine. A lot of people didn't get work during the quarantine. I was able to stay employed, well paid, even during lockdown, not even leaving my basement. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I had a previous guest on. We were talking about, you know, what made Superman, it's what made Superman and Batman who they are. And it's their parents. It's their surroundings. If you're surrounded by love, if you're surrounded by creativity, That's the ultimate superpower. Yeah. Kal-El from Krypton had super strength and lasers coming out of his eyes, and he could run real fast and cold breath coming out of his mouth and X-ray vision. But the ultimate superpower was his ultimate superpower was growing up at Smallville, you know, with great parents, great people around him that inspired him to do the right thing. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we miss as a society. And then it goes back to the show, The Office. I don't know if you ever watched The Office, but you know, Dwight, being the narcissist, psychotic weirdo that he is, Dwight, there was an episode where it was Daddy Daughter Day, and everybody that had daughters brought their daughters to work. And Toby walks through the little kitchen area with his daughter. And even Dwight looks at her and says, "Hello, child, you're the future." And like, you know, it's that is. That's the ultimate superpower, is the parenting and the upbringing and what you leave your children. I mean, there are churches in the South, there are churches, pastors, I don't know if they still do it now, probably, but they might, that preach racist ideals, racially biased, prejudiced, racist ideals, a church. I mean, that is damaging to a society, and we're obviously seeing it over there at the insurrection at the Capitol.
Definitely.
But you know, it's like parents need to make a choice. You know, I've had family members that were homophobic, racist, and it's like you're making a choice to pass this on to your offspring, and you're either creating villains or you're creating heroes.
Yeah, somebody told me once that if you divided the world into two categories, which just sounds terrible, but there's fear and there's love. And I think, when I look at people who are, making bad causes, really bad causes, then they're obviously not caring about other people but themselves, But I always think, like, wow, they're so far away from their core being, in the middle of all of us is this beam of light, this energy, vibration that we came in as who we are, right? And everything that surrounds that is, like you were saying, is created, by environment, parents, how we're raised and all this stuff, belief systems and all those things. And also, like from a Buddhist perspective, we're carrying karma from past lives too. So we all have a layer of karma, right? But underneath that, in the very middle, is this beam of pure light. And for me, that's the core, your relationship to the universe, your relationship with God, or whatever you want to call it, my relationship with myself, right? If we're very close to that core being, we won't really go off. We'll have the capacity to care for other people. However, if that's closed down and you can't see anything else, then people get very, like, then they're angry. Then they want to pick up a gun or what. I don't know the reason anybody would want to do that, but they want to harm other people. That's where that comes from, I think. But I do think that there's people that came here because they wanted to start a war. I mean, maybe that's their creativity coming in. I wonder about that because I think, like, why? Why is there war, Because it doesn't do anybody any good. But I do.
And to touch upon that, yeah, and I don't mean to interrupt, but what came to my mind when you were speaking about this, you know, light with inside, and I feel that, you know, depending on your influences, your parent, depending on your parents and the choices your parents make and the choices you make, and your upbringing and your surroundings, and a lot of this has a lot to do with it. You know, that phrase, "It takes a village to raise a child," you know, and all that stuff. And so going back to that light, and what I was picturing when you were talking about it is that there's either going to be stuff thrown at you as a person that's either going to well, for there's going to be stuff that's going to cover it and dim it down and corrupt it and rot it. You know, if you take a light and you throw a lot of mud on it, can't see the light. But if you take a light and you put a lens and then another lens and then kind of like one of those crystal ball, crystal chandelier kind of things around it, then that light is like exaggerated and sprayed even more. But if you throw mud and shit all over this light, then you're going to rot the lens. It's going to cover the light first off, then it's going to rot the lens. It might rust. It might rust the metal. Going back to, like, I'm a filmmaker, so I'm always thinking like this big high power light, right? But it starts rotting that light, and then the rest of you gets rotted because that light is not being exuded. And I always go back to, like, I love what I do, right? I'm not making $1 million a year. I'm not making $1 billion a year from it, but I love what I do, to where I've had jobs where it was only 8 hours a day and I went home drained and exhausted and burnt out because I hated it. But I've had gigs that were 10, 12, 16-hour days and still went home and wanted to talk to my wife all night and got up early the next morning to go back to day two, to day five, to day seven, because I was so amped to do it because I loved what I was doing on that film. And it goes back to that, like, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more about that whole light thing, because if you're there, I mean, there are, I've had family members that try to just straight up extinguish someone's light. Like, I went to film school to be a writer, director, producer, graduated, and then I think a year or two after graduation, I went to film fighting and stunt school, and someone was like, why are you? Yeah. But someone had the audacity. It's like, well, why are you going to there? I thought you wanted to be a film editor. I'm like, first off, like, I never told you I wanted to be a film editor. I told you I wanted to be a filmmaker. But what difference is it? I'm going to this film fighting stunt school. I'm like expanding, but everybody has to shit talk something. Everybody has to diminish other folks' accomplishments and enthusiasm and positivity.
Because they're not happy.
And because they're not happy, they're fucking
That's the key.
miserable. Excuse my
That's,
language, but they're
yeah, that's
miserable.
true.
They're fearful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Misery, misery loves company.
they've been taught, like I was taught by my parents, there's no such thing as a free lunch and you came here to suffer. And I'm like, no. What it made me think of was Nichiren Daishonin, this 13th century monk from Japan. He said, a cave that's been dark for 10,000 years, you can light a match and it lights up the whole cave. And I thought that's what happens when people wake up, to their mission. That's kind of what happens. I think they see their purpose. And I think, I had a saying like, you could fuck with me, but don't fuck with my mission, because if you know what your mission is, whatever it is, even if it's just to write songs and sing, whatever that is that's your path, that's your thing, whatever that is. And so I agree with you. I did think of, though, when you were saying about throwing mud on the light and kind of crushing it, that's the family I grew up in. I grew up in a family that was incredibly abusive. They were bipolar, manic depressive, the whole bunch of them, and they didn't want you to be happy. Actually, it was like having a mother that wanted that was competing with you in a way. You can't have that because I didn't have that, which
Right.
is so weird. Because to me,
Exactly.
like being a parent, to me, I'd be like, I want you to have everything I didn't have. Let me give you the world. That's what I want to do, and that's love, right? But people that grew up in fear, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So, I had to kind of take the mud off of myself every
Yeah.
day. And my dad, whenever I talked about loving music or wanting to be a musician, my father would say to me, "What do you think? You're special?" And I couldn't answer, yes, because I'd be beaten, because I was beaten up every day, basically, until I left. But, there was this tiny little beam, and it's like that little match in the cave. There was this tiny little beam of light in me, and this tiny little voice I'd hear myself say, "Yes, I'm special." It was
Yeah.
this belief system underneath all the mud that was like, yeah, I am. I mean, we all are. We all came here for a reason. And we're all precious beings, you know. So it goes back to the love thing, and we have to learn how to shine the light on ourselves,
I mean, I've had.
and then we can actually shine it on other people. And what a brilliant thing to be able to do, you know, when we're able to shine a light on other people and give them that energy and give them that love. That's what people are dying or really needing right now, I think, more than anything. And that's why people are desperate to get together, you know. They're so desperate to get together, they'll put their lives at risk. That's crazy, but I understand it. I miss everybody too. So, yeah, I feel incredibly fortunate to have found my path, and that's what keeps me going, you know. And music saved my life. So I'm always going to be grateful to the arts and to music. And anybody that teaches music or teaches the arts or encourages a kid to pick up a camera, you know, any kind of art to me is a blessing, a gift. And so yeah, if you're a young person out there, please pursue your dream and never give up.
Well, Roberta Donnay, I can't thank you enough. This was a blast. I mean, truly inspired, and this was a doozy. So, I think we'll cut it short here. But Roberta, don't go anywhere. We're gonna chat a little bit offline. But we got RobertaDonnay.com. We got Roberta Donnay on Facebook, Roberta Donnay on Twitter, Donnay Roberta on Instagram. Check her out. A lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. Film, music, history buff. Stuff from all over the US and Europe with jazz. So links all the links for that will be in the description below. Check this stuff out. Roberta, don't go anywhere.